I'd like to begin the message this morning by, first of all, giving a warning, most specifically for those who are in the tape ministry. And that is, I feel it's only right that I do this, and that is give a warning to the fact that there is going to be some material at the end of this message that probably would not be the best for small ears to hear. And so I've already warned my wife of that for our children's sake, and I want to do it for the sake of those in the tape ministry as well. Title of this, the series that we're in, as all of you are well aware, is Know Thine Enemy, and this is part four. You know, there is no doubt today, it's been established, I think, very well in the last three messages, that Christianity today is under attack. But let me give you some further evidence, and I, interestingly, received this from two different sources just last week. Right after the service, I was given an article, and then in the mail, I received a similar article quoting the same source. Let me read to you from some comments, or a comment from a particular attorney in America today. First of all, in May of this year, and this, we're talking current, in May of this year, the American Bar Association sponsored a seminar for trial lawyers, instructing them how to use tort law against religious organizations and individuals. Now, when I say that they were being instructed on how to use tort law against religious organizations and individuals, I think you probably understand that we're not talking about Hindus or Muslims or anything of that kind. They are specifically centering in on Christianity. The attack is against Christianity. And according to Attorney J. Shelby Sharp, in the Chalcedon Report, October 1989, just 2 months ago, he says this, quote, "War has been declared, and Christianity is in a fight to the death," end quote. That came from an attorney who either was involved in that particular seminar or at least was made aware of it. We are in a fight, and the evidence is there before us. We've talked about it in the past, and it just keeps coming forward all the time that Christianity is being attacked today, and anyone who cannot see that in America today is simply blind. Maybe they fit into the and of course I think we're in the age of the Laodicean church when he says you can't see, yet you need eye salve to anoint your eyes so that you can see. And probably the biggest majority of the people in probably most specifically the religious world today cannot see that there is an attack, an all-out attack on Christianity today. You know, that should not surprise us, what I just read, that quote from Attorney Sharp. That shouldn't surprise us at all because it fits in exactly with the plan that I quoted to you found in the Russian textbook on psychopolitics called Brainwashing. It's exactly what they said is their plan to do to Christianity. Now, that was written back in the 1800s. It was written back in the 1800s, and it's obviously taken some time in order to accomplish their purposes. But you can see that there has been an escalated attack on Christianity through the judicial system, as in the illustration or the figures that I gave you in a couple messages past, in the figures regarding cases involving church groups in America. In 1976, again, there were only 45 different cases in all of America against religious groups, Christianity specifically. Just 4 short years later, in 1980, it had gone from 45 to 2,100 cases against religious groups, against Christianity. 2 years later, it doubled in 1982 to 4,000, and in 1985, it jumped to 8,000, and I don't have the current figures. But you can bet, after this particular seminar, it's going to escalate even more than it has over the last decade. You know, if Christianity is under attack, and I don't think anyone that has any brains about them at all can ever deny that, if Christianity is under attack, then Christians certainly have enemies. That cannot be debated. You know, the enemies of Christianity certainly come in different forms, and we've talked about some of that. We're going to be talking about more of it as this series go on. The enemies of Christianity do come in different forms, but there appears to be a particular group that is behind the scenes in most cases. You know, there has certainly been a great deception that has taken, that it has and is taking place throughout America and throughout the world in the last 2,000 years. And that deception, especially in the recent years of the last 2,000 years, there has been this great deception that has taken place. And I believe that deception is spoken of, by Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 3, if you turn there with me, please. 2 Timothy chapter 3, and I want to read verse 13. I believe warns us of this great deception that is taking place today and has been over the centuries. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 13. It says, "But evil men and imposters will proceed from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived." You notice first how these people are described? They're described not only as evil men, but also as imposters, and that they're deceivers. Same thing that we find in 2 John 7 in the description of the Antichrist. They're imposters. 2 Timothy 3 warns us, Paul warns us, of deceivers who are imposters. Let me ask you, who are these imposters that Paul is referring to here in 2 Timothy chapter 3? Let's turn over to Philippians 3, and I believe that we'll start to see these imposters identified. Philippians chapter 3. I'd like to read the first three verses of Philippians 3. Philippians 3, starting with verse 1, it says, "Finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. To write the same things again is no trouble to me, and it is a safeguard for you." And verse 2 specifically, it says, "Beware of the dogs. Beware of the evil workers." Now let's go back to the dogs. He says, "Beware of the dogs." Now let me ask you, do you think he's talking about the kind of situation that postmen have to be concerned about when they're walking up to a fence that has "Beware of the dog" on it? That's not what he's talking about here, obviously, because it goes further on identifying who and what he's talking about. It says, "Beware of the dog. Beware of the evil workers." We're right back to what was said in 2 Timothy chapter 3. It started off with, there will be evil workers, imposters. Here we're talking about evil workers again. "Beware of the dogs. Beware of the evil workers. Beware of the false circumcision. For we are the true circumcision, who worship in the Spirit of God and glory in the Christ Yeshua, and put no confidence in the flesh." Did you hear verse 2? It said that these people are a false circumcision. They're imposters. Talking about the same group of people. The same words are almost used in this passage as we found Paul using in 1 Timothy chapter 3. They're evil workers, and they're false. They're a false circumcision, or they're imposters. But he also calls them dogs. Well, let me ask you, who are the dogs as described in the Scriptures? Well, I believe we find the answer to that in Matthew chapter 15. Now, as we turn to this particular passage, I want to pre-warn you that many people do not like. It's interesting. They don't necessarily not like this passage. They just don't like people who explain to them what this passage very clearly is saying. If you want to become a racist in people's eyes, if you want to be called a bigot, if you want to be called a white supremacist, boy, tell them what this passage is obviously saying. Now, I feel like if we're honest with what this passage says, I don't even need to tell you what it says. It speaks for itself. But let's go through it. Matthew chapter 15, and starting with verse 21, and trying to see if the Scriptures identify who the dogs are in the Scriptures. Verse 21, it says, "And Yahshua went away from there and withdrew into the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman came out from that region and began to cry out, saying, 'Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed.' But he did not answer her a word." Now, isn't that interesting? That doesn't necessarily fit in with the Christ that is often preached from the Judeo-Christian pulpits today, does it? We don't think of a Christ going around when he's being addressed and being petitioned and being asked to perform something kind for the sake of someone else as just ignoring them. He begins by not answering this woman a word. "He did not answer a word," verse 23, "and his disciples came to him and kept asking him, saying, 'Send her away, for she is shouting out after us.' But he answered and said, 'I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.'" Now let's stop there for a minute. Now notice that he uses an animal to describe a group of people. He uses the animals known as sheep. Is he talking about literal sheep here? No. He very clearly says that the sheep, in God's mind, are the Israelite people. And if you doubt that or question what Yahshua is saying here, just go back and read the Old Testament. Over and over and over again, God's people, Israel, are described as sheep. Now, carrying on with that understanding, again verse 24, he says, "But he answered and said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she came and began to bow down before him, saying, Lord, help me. And he answered and said, It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now let me ask you, again, I don't believe that this needs much explanation. If you understand that he was calling a group of people, a race of people, the Israelites, as we're calling his people, the Israelite sheep, then it's very easily understood that when he said this to this Canaanite woman, he was addressing the word dog to not four-footed creatures or anything else. He was addressing it to a two-legged race of people, or lineage of people is probably better put. Now, I don't personally believe that Yahshua here was calling this woman specifically as an individual dog. I don't believe he was looking at her as an individual and saying, you're a dog. I think what he was doing with the mind of God that he had, he was saying, there is a group of people in this world, in contrast to a people I understand and call my sheep, I call another people dogs. I don't believe he was even meaning to be deflammatory when he used that statement. It was just a matter of fact, in comparison to his people who are called sheep and their response unto God, there was a group of people existing on the face of this earth, a lineage of people who, because of their response unto God, God considered the race of people as dogs. Now, people don't like that when you point that out. But I ask you, can anybody come up with any other explanation from this passage of what Yahshua was calling the Canaanite people? Now, if you don't like what Yahshua had to say, maybe you'll accept what the woman herself declared. Let's go on and let's read how she responded to this. Notice in verse 26, he said to this woman, and he answered and said, "It is not good to take the children's bread," and we know who the children were here, it was Israel. It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs, talking about the Canaanites. And then notice her response. But she said, "No, Lord, we're not dogs." And notice what she said. But she said, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from the master's table." She herself recognized that the people she was a part of were dogs in God's sight. Now, I believe this woman was an exception to the rule. She was a woman who was willing to look to Yahshua, and there are exceptions today of people who fit into this lineage today, as we saw from last week's message, that there are people in that group of people that are exceptions to the rule, and who will accept truth and will proclaim truth and maybe sometimes even embrace the Savior, at least maybe in this sense of looking and knowing that He has the answers for life and freedom and healing. But the woman herself understood who and what she was as a lineage of people. But the question, of course, is, well, here we have we identify the dogs as being the Canaanites, or Yahshua and the woman identify the dogs as being Canaanites. But who are the Canaanites? Well, they were identified in our last message as Hivites and Hittites that Esau, Jacob's brother, married into. The Hivites and the Hittites that Esau married were called Canaanites in the very same passage, and who at the time of Esther took on the name and the religion of the Jews. That is who the Canaanites are. The Canaanites are who the dogs are, and the dogs are who the imposters are. And it fits perfectly in with a passage that I've used several times, found in Revelation chapter 2, 9, and 3, 9, where it says there are Jews who call themselves Jews but are not and lie and are a synagogue of Satan. The Scriptures make it very clear there are imposters, and that there is a great deception that it started back then. John makes it very clear that the Antichrist deceivers were amongst them at that time and have continued as time has gone on. There has been a great deception today, and that deception has been perpetuated by a certain group of people, without doubt. Who are the imposters today?
Who are the deceivers? Who are the dogs? Who are the evil workers? It is the Jews today who call themselves God's chosen people. That is the greatest counterfeit that has ever been pulled off in the history of mankind. And they are the enemy, in most cases, behind the scenes, pulling the strings. And let me read it to you once again, as is described by themselves in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, in protocol number 13 and article 6. And again, I quote, it says, "Who will ever suspect then that all these peoples were stage managed by us according to a political plan which no one has so much as guessed at in the course of many centuries?" End quote. In last week's message, we revealed from specifically the Scriptures. And I wanted to establish it from the Scriptures first, because it certainly can be established from the Scriptures. And when it can be established from the Scriptures, when anything can be established from the Scriptures, it needs to be first established from the Scriptures. Because nothing is as important as what the Scriptures reveal. In last week's message, we revealed from the Scriptures how modern-day Jewry and ancient communism, not even known as communism, at least at the beginning, but how modern-day Jewry and ancient communism have the same roots. How ancient communism is identified with Babylon, and how Babylon is seen to be one and the same as Edom, and how Edom is found in modern Jewry today. Now again, that's a broad statement, not including all who are call themselves Jews today. But more than likely, it's the biggest majority of them that are involved in, again, as I've mentioned, Talmudic Zionism. What I want to do in the message today is now go from the Scriptures. We established it in the Scriptures. We can see it in the Scriptures that God didn't leave us not to know. It's not necessarily easy found, and it certainly isn't preached from across most of the pulpits today, but it certainly can be found that modern Jewry and ancient communism certainly have the same roots. We've established it from the Scriptures, and what I'd like to do now in this message is further establish it and further prove it from historical evidence as well. To begin with, going back to the beginnings of what has been called communist, there were six men who were responsible for leading the revolt in Russia. Lenin, Trotsky, now I'm not some of these other not-so-familiar names, I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce right. Probably none of you can pronounce them right either, so I'm probably safe. But Lenin, Trotsky, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Sverdlov, and Lunacheski, or something close to those names. Now listen to the six men. Those six men were involved in the beginning of the revolt in Russia, without a doubt. Nobody can deny those facts. And five of them were Jews. Trotsky's real name was Lev Bronstein. Lenin's was Chaim Goldman, and their plan was written by Karl Marx, the son of a Jewish rabbi. You know, according to data found data furnished by the Soviet press, out of 556 important functionaries of the Bolshevik state, in the beginnings in 1918 and 1919, 457 were Jews. Out of 556 important functionaries of the Bolshevik state, 457 of them were Jews. Let me share with you a couple quotes in that regard from the little booklet that I've used before. Why don't you believe what we tell you? Different quotes from Jews themselves. Let me read just a couple of these. Quote, "The Jews in Russia in their total mass were responsible for the revolution." That was by Angelo S. Rappaport, "The Pioneers of the Russian Revolution," page 250. Stanley, Paul, and C. London, 1918, were the publishers. Or how about this one? From the Jewish Chronicle in London, April 4th, 1919. Pay close attention to the dates that I give you here. Quote, "There is much in the fact of Bolshevism itself, in the fact that so many Jews are Bolshevists. The ideals of Bolshevism are consonant with many of the highest ideals of Judaism. End quote. Or how about from the American Hebrew, September 10, 1920? Quote, the Bolshevist revolution in Russia was the work of Jewish brains, of Jewish dissatisfaction, of Jewish planning, whose goal is to create a new order. Keep that in mind with what's going on here currently throughout the world. Whose goal is to create a new order in the world. What was performed in so excellent a way in Russia, thanks to Jewish brains and because of Jewish dissatisfaction and by Jewish planning, shall also through the same Jewish mental and physical forces become a reality all over the world. And then one more in this book from Harry Watton, A Program for the Jews and an Answer to all Anti-Semites, page 148, written in 1939. Quote, it is not an accident that Judaism gave birth to Marxism, and it is not an accident that the Jews readily took up Marxism, all that is in perfect accord with the progress of Judaism and the Jews. End quote. You know, this is all verified, I should say, to be true. He didn't like those sources. This is all verified to be true in a 1907 National Geographic magazine. Now, for the sake of the tape audience, I want you to know that I have a photocopy of the whole article of that National Geographic magazine in my hand. I'm not going to be reading a quote from somebody else's quote from somebody else's quote. I'm going to be reading from that 1907 National Geographic magazine. Very hard to come by because of who's taking control of the National Geographic magazine. Was not controlled as it back then as it is today. Listen to this quote. It verifies the very things that the Jews themselves admit. In an article entitled The 1905 Revolution in Russia, here there's a heading within the article that says The Vengeance of the Jews. It says, perhaps these reforms are the cause of the present tranquility because the revolutionary leaders nearly all belong to the Jewish race, and the most effective revolutionary agency is the Jewish Bund, which has its headquarters at Bialystok, where the massacre occurred last June. The government has suffered more from that race than from all of its other subjects combined. Whenever a desperate deed is committed, it is always done by a Jew, and there is scarcely one loyal member of that race in the entire empire. The great strike which paralyzed the empire and compelled the Tsar to grant a constitution and a parliament was ordered and managed by a Jew named Khrushchev, president of the Workingmen's Council, a young man only of 30 years old. A little later, this article says, Maxim, who organized and conducted the revolution in the Baltic province, is a Jew of marvelous ability. A little later, he says, Gershenin, the most resourceful leader of the terrorists, who was condemned to the imprisonment in the silver mines on the Mongolian frontier, has recently escaped in a water cask and is supposed to be in San Francisco. He is a Polish Jew, only 27 years old. Now, listen carefully to this next statement. He says, I might enumerate 100 other revolutionary leaders, and every one of them would be a Jew. Wherever you read of the assassination or of the explosion of a bomb, you will notice in the newspaper dispatches that the man was a Jew. The most sensational and dramatic episode that has occurred since the mutinies was on October 27th, when in the very center of St. Petersburg, at the entrance of the Kazan Cathedral, four Jews held up the treasury wagon and captured $2,700,000. They passed the package to a woman who instantly vanished, and no trace of her has ever been found. But they were all arrested and were promptly punished. On the 8th of November, a few Jewish revolutionaries entered a treasury car near Rogow in Poland, got $850,000, and disappeared. Every deed of that kind is done by Jews and the massacres that have shocked the universe. Now, it goes on to explain even more. But I think that's enough to suffice to show that what I've stated and what I have quoted already to this point in time is backed up by that 1907 article about the revolution that took place in 1905. Who was behind it? According to that article, not according to me, you don't have to believe me if you don't want to, but according to that article in the National Geographic magazine, the Jewish mind was behind it. Let's go on in time. After World War II, the following Jews ruled in Europe. Rakowski in Hungary, G. Jacob Berman in Poland, Anna Pocker in Romania, Rudolf Slansky in Czechoslovakia, and Kaganovich in Russia through Stalin. In America, the Jew Gerhard Eisler, ran the Communist Party from 1935 to 1947. His right-hand man was J. Peters, whose real name was Goldberger, and he was Jewish. In 1950, 10 Hollywood writers and directors were convicted of contempt of Congress for refusing to answer questions about their communist connections. There were 10 who were convicted, 9 were Jews, and 6 of them were party members of the communists. After the conviction of the ones I just named, the second string Politburo took over the American Communist Party. Of these 21, 14 were Jews, 1 was a mistress of a Jew, and 2 were colored. Now let me go back to this little book and, in light of that, share a couple other quotes from Why Don't You Believe What I Tell You. It says, it is often said that Judaism, now we've come forward in time, that Judaism is the driving force of communism. But this does not prove anything beyond that which is expected and only natural. It is surprising that Judaism should become the fermenting and destructive element in... Is it surprising that Judaism should become the fermenting and destructing element in countries which have always despised and persecuted it? That particular facility for intrigue, stratagem, conspiracies, and that patient, almost uncanny waiting for the hour of never-failing revenge are all characteristics of the, I'll have to put quotes around this, the chosen people. Now, they want to claim that, of course, when it certainly is not true and cannot be verified. That was Professor F.A. Ostendowski, The 19th Century and After. That was the book published in London, page 29, January 1926. Let's go on to a couple others. Here's another one by Reinhold Niebuhr, speech before the Jewish Institute of Religion, New York, October 3rd, 1934. Quote, simply, Marxism is the modern form of Jewish prophecy, end quote. Or here's a very familiar one. Some call it Marxism, I call it Judaism, by Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, in the American Bulletin, May 5th, 1935. And one more. It says, quote, if the tide of history does not turn toward communist internationalism, then the Jewish race is doomed. You notice what it said. If the tide of history does not turn toward communist internationalism, then the Jewish race is doomed. And I ask you, has the tide turned toward communist internationalism today? It certainly has. By George Marlin in the book Stalin, Trotsky, and Lenin, page 414, New York, 1937. You know, have you ever wondered where the better read than dead philosophy comes from? Let me read to you, and listen, you have to listen closely to this, but I believe this is basically where it comes from. Let me read once again from the book, The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. This will be protocol number 14 in Article 1. Listen very closely to what this says. See if you can't see the better read than dead philosophy coming out of this. It says, then at every possible opportunity, we shall publish articles in which we shall make comparisons between our beneficent rule and those of past ages. Now keep in mind who is speaking here. Who are the writers of the learned, of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion? Again, it says that at every possible opportunity we shall publish articles in which we shall make comparisons between our beneficent rule and those of past ages. The blessings of tranquility, though it be a tranquility forcibly brought about by centuries of agitation, will throw into higher relief the benefits to which we shall point. The errors of the Goyim governments will be depicted by us in the most vivid hues. We shall implant such an abhorrence of them that the peoples will prefer tranquility in a state of serfdom to those rights of vaunted sources of human existence, sources which have been exploited by a mob of rascally adventurers who know not what they do. Unless changes of forms of government to which we instigated the Goyim when we were undermining their state structures, I have a bad habit of pronouncing that word wrong, as has been pointed out. Unless changes of forms of government to which we instigated the Goyim when we were undermining their state structures will have so wearied the peoples by that time that they will prefer to suffer anything under us rather than to run the risk of enduring again all the agitations and miseries they have gone through." End quote. I don't know about you, but I see coming from that the redder, better read than dead philosophy that is so common today.
At least 1935 or 1937, but I can hear people saying, "Man, that is so far gone, it doesn't matter anymore." Well, I question that to begin with. But I can still hear them saying, "Let's have a more up-to-date quote." Well, you want a more up-to-date quote? Let me give you one. How about New York Times article, July 14, 1987? Listen to what this says. Quote, "Another reason," now this was what was being spoken of, "for the real longing in Israel," specifically speaking about the Jews, "for the real longing in Israel," the Jews that are there, "for a restoration of ties in Moscow." And that's what the article was about. "Another reason for this longing by the Jews to be tied back in with Moscow, is the similarity between Israel and the Soviet political cultures." Goes on to say, "It is true we," speaking about the Jews, "it is true we may be a democracy with 8 different parties, but each one of our parties is Bolshevik in both style and organization. Also, many Israelis were raised on the socialist dream and with revolutionary traditions." End quote. You want a more recent quote? You've got it. New York Times, 1987. But again, I can just hear some people. "But wait a minute! What about the Russians or the communists being so anti-Semitic, if I can say it that way? That's not the way I want to say it. People are going to say, wait a minute, what about the Russians or the communists being so anti-Semitic, as is so often portrayed in the American media today? We hear it over and over and over again that the Russians are the most anti-Semitic people on the face of this earth, or the communists are. Isn't that what we're told continually by our American press? Well, I ask you, keep in mind who runs the American press and who it is, or keep in mind that it is those very same people that are described as deceivers in the Scriptures. Those are the people who are running the American press, and we'll do a whole message on that probably, or at least part of a message on that very thing, on who is behind the American media today. But we're hearing it all the time in the American media, but we've got to keep in mind who is controlling and where that thought is coming from. Let me read to you from, I don't want to forget something here that I've passed over here. Let me put it up here so I don't forget to use it here. In light of what I just said, let me read from Kenneth Goff's book, To Still Our Ancient Foe, a couple quotes that he has in this book, so I save me from this, from having to write them down myself. In regards to this idea that the communists are so anti-Semitic, listen to what he quotes here. In an article in November 1936 issue of Soviet Russia Today, a Mr. Levine wrote, quote, "Special concern," that was back in 1936, "special concern of the Jewish people has characterized the Soviet Union since its birth in the 1917 revolution. A week after Tsarism was overthrown, the infant socialist government, headed by Lenin, legally abolished national oppression, making it the first country in the world to declare anti-Semitism a crime. Every manifestation of anti-Semitism was fought openly and sternly," end quote. Or here's another one. Alexander Bittelman, a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of America, has this to say about the Jews' rise to power through communism. Quote, "If not for the Red Army, there would be no Jews in Europe today, nor in Palestine, nor in Africa, and in the United States. The length of their existence would be counted in days. The Soviet Union has saved the Jewish people. Therefore, let the American Jewish masses never forget their historical debt to the savior of the Jewish people, the Soviet Union," end quote. And another one.
There's a book that further states, the book entitled The Role of the Jews in the Partisan Movement in the United States, written by Moshe Kaganovich, states this, that Russia has saved 10 times more Jews from extermination than all the other nations combined, including the Israeli state. It further states on page 23, under the caption, Soviet Fight Against Racism, quote, from the very first day of its existence, the Soviet Union took steps to eradicate anti-Semitism. On July 27, 1919, a special decree was issued by the communist government against anti-Semitism. I guess that's all I want to read from there at this point in time. Also, here's another interesting quote in light of what I just read you from those. From the Daily Worker, December 2, 1938, in an editorial entitled Stalin and Anti-Semitism, we find this. Quote, in the USSR, anti-Semitism, and let's understand that when they use the word anti-Semitism in this regard, they're talking about anti-Judaism. They're not accurate in what they call, what they describe as Semites, so they're not accurate in what they call anti-Semites. They're talking about anti-Judaism. Quote again, in the USSR, anti-Semitism is strictly prosecuted as a phenomena profoundly hostile to the Soviet system. According to the laws of the USSR, active anti-Semites are punished by death. End quote. Now, it's interesting because it's also, those are quotes from the Soviet side, it is also established from the Israeli side as well. Let me read again from To Still Our Ancient Foe, pages 96 and 97. That the Jewish masses of the Israeli state recognizes the Soviet Union as a friend can be seen in the great amount of business done between the two nations and in the fact that on August 8, 1948, the right-wing newspaper of Israeli, Haboker, stated, quote, the words and deeds of the Soviet representatives in dark hours have sunk into our memory. The firm and consistent support of Israel by the USSR at Lake Success has given the USSR and its statements a place of honor in the history of Israel. The Israelis are admitting it as well. The Jewish Federation of Labor organ, Devar, wrote, well, we'll never forget the friendship the USSR showed us in the worst hour when the State of Israel was established and was struggling for its existence. End quote. The Constitution, how about the Constitution of the Communist Party of the United States of America? Do they say anything different here in America, at least to themselves? The Constitution of the Communist Party of the United States of America, in Article 6, Section 7, follows the ideas of the Soviet as it states, quote, it shall be the obligations of all party members to struggle against all forms of national oppression, national chauvinism, discrimination and segregation, against all ideological influences and practices of racial theories, such as white chauvinism and anti-Semitism. End quote. You know, there's no question that when you look at the quotes, when you get down to past the media smear that has taken place, that the Soviets are pro-Jewish and that the Jews or the Israelis are pro-Soviets or pro-communism. You know, the evidence of the media smear is found very easily in the 1952 edition of the American Jewish Yearbook, Volume 53. Let me quote from it. It says, the widely publicized recent indictments and trials for espionage, the evidence brought forth at investigative hearings and elsewhere, gave rise early last summer to a concern lest the result an increasing association of Jews with communism in the minds of the general public. Now that again is in the 1952 edition of the American Jewish Yearbook. Volume 53. They understand we've got to do something. Too many people are starting to realize that there's a link between between Judaism, or at least Talmudic Zionism, and communism today. They said something has to be done. By the order of the American Jewish Committee, quote, an intensive educational program addressed to the Jews and non-Jews alike with respect to communism, end quote, was adopted. During 1950, we stressed the role of the Jew against communism. We have employed the mass media to feature the activities of Jewish individuals who vigorously oppose communist totalitarianism. End quote. Did you notice they said, we have employed the mass media, we've employed them to do this great cover-up for us, to convince at least the American people, if not the rest of the world — most of the rest of the world hasn't been near as gullible — but to convince at least the American world that there is no link and that the two are totally opposed to each other, when indeed they're not. You know, that shouldn't surprise us, because Jeremiah 8:8, Jeremiah very aptly describes and warns us of the lying pens of the scribes. I think I'll save this quote I didn't share with you for a later time. It doesn't really fit in at this point. Let me share this just for extra, since we're talking about communism at this point in time. You know, let's not be fooled. I'm afraid that probably most of America has, but let's not be fooled by the quote-unquote tearing down of the Iron Curtain over in East Germany. Let's not be fooled. Let's not be thinking, oh, this is a great, great victory for Americanism and for freedom. Let's not be fooled by what really has taken place over there. I'd like you to turn with me, if you would, to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy 28, of course, is known as that great chapter on the blessings and cursings for Israel, depending on their obedience or non-obedience to God's laws. Deuteronomy 28, and starting with verse 9 and 10, we'll see that God promised certain blessings to Israel if they indeed would follow Him and His laws. Verse 9, it says, Yahweh will establish you as a holy people to Himself, as He swore to you, if you will keep the commandments of Yahweh your God and walk in His ways. So all the peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of Yahweh, and they shall be afraid of you. And then it goes from there and it enumerates the different blessings that will come upon Israel if they'll simply be obedient to His laws. Let's jump down to verse 15. Here we find it says, But it shall come upon you if you will not obey Yahweh your God, to observe to do all His commandments and His statutes, with which I charge you today, that all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Enumerates through Moses the blessings that will come upon Israel if she will simply believe and follow him. But she says, if you will not accept and obey my commandments as coming from me, then these are the curses. And he then enumerates the curses that would come upon Israel for their disobedience. And if you jump down to verse 25, we'll start to see, or we'll find within these curses, one of the curses that will be brought down upon Israel. Verse 25, it says, Yahweh will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them, but you shall flee seven ways before them, and you shall be an example of terror to all the kingdoms of the earth. Let's begin by noticing here that God Himself says, I will bring the enemies upon you. Christian Israel certainly has enemies today, but based on this passage, let's understand who has brought those enemies upon her and why these enemies were brought upon Israel. Israel, when it comes right down to it, is to blame. And can you look out at America today and say that we don't deserve it? When you look at where the normal Israelite or Caucasian mind is at today, most of the time it's in the gutter, whether it be in pornography or because of drugs or whatever other moral decadent thing they've got themselves involved in. And he says, I will bring it upon you. So let's not forget that the enemies we have are brought upon us by God. But it certainly says that enemies will be brought. Now jump over to verses 47 and 48. And notice closely what it says here. It says, Because you did not serve Yahweh your God with joy and a glad heart for the abundance of all things, therefore you shall serve your enemies, whom Yahweh shall send against you, in hunger, in thirst, in nakedness, and in the lack of all things. And then listen to what he says. And he will put an iron yoke on your neck until he has destroyed you. You know, there is no need for iron curtains in the world today when the rest of the world has been enslaved to the point by communism that everyone is wearing an iron collar or an iron yoke. God promised it. You know, that is simply a political, a beautiful political move by the communists. Let's tear down the wall. Let's convince America that we're really serious about this. How's the word pronounced? Perestroika? Thank you. I won't even try. Let's convince them that we're serious about this thing, about peace. And as the scriptures so aptly depict and warn us, be careful when everyone is saying, peace, peace, for sudden destruction will come. Let's not be fooled by the iron, quote-unquote, iron curtains being torn down, because it simply isn't needed anymore when everyone else is wearing an iron yoke. We've been enslaved. You know, some I can hear today, too, saying, some would maybe ask, why go to all the trouble of documenting the fact that Judaism is behind modern-day communism? Why go to all that trouble? Well, in reference to that, let me read to you again the thing that motivated this series. The meeting I had with the John Birch Society gal down at the Denver Gun Show last August. Let me read again to you part of the letter that I wrote back to her, and I think it will again help explain why it's important for us to document the fact that it is indeed Judaism that's behind communism today. I'll just read a part of it this time. I might ask you at this point, why are most communists so anti-Christ or anti-Christian? Because communism is, as proven in some of the enclosed literature that I had sent to her, a Jewish-begun and controlled organization. Yes, there are other races involved in communism, just as there are other races involved today in Hinduism, but where does their theology originate from? Is it wrong to pinpoint the origin of communism? No, it is imperative that we do so. If we don't, we will fall into the trap described by Robert Welch in the chapter entitled Political Neutralism. That is, we will find ourselves fighting only a front created by the enemy behind the scenes. Now, don't get me wrong. I am as anti-communism as you are, but I believe that I am more effective as an anti-communist, for I know my enemy better than you, at least at this point. And for anyone to fight and win against any foe, one must know his enemy. Today, not only do most Christians and John Birch Society members not know their enemy, they are supporting their enemy by claiming these antichrists to be God's chosen people. Let me ask you, do you think communism is just a political movement? No, it's a religious movement. And until one understands this, any efforts made against it will be next to, if not totally ineffective. The world conquest being waged between the promoters of communism and the promoters of freedom is none other than a battle between Esau Edom and Jacob Israel. Esau and his descendants, the modern-day Jews, are simply trying to regain the birthright and blessing lost to Jacob and his descendants, the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred people. Both groups are, or at least should be, interested in establishing a one-world government. Esau Edom, with his communist arm, wants to establish their one-world government for their own glory and power. Jacob Israel wants to see the kingdom of God, a one-world government system, established to the praise and glory of Almighty God. You know, there is indeed a battle being waged this very day between Jacob Israel and Esau Edom. It started all the way back when those two twin brothers fought over the birthright, and one lost it, what was rightfully his. But it was given to a new lineage of people known as Israel. And that war is still waging. It has not stopped. And communism is certainly a part of it. You know, we need to understand the mind of those who are waging this all-out war against Christianity. And I want to read to you one more quote. I can hardly say that it's well put, because I don't like reading what I'm going to read to you. It's something that is not easily heard, and not easily read by me, but it's something that we certainly need to hear and understand and know has taken place, and certainly will, is the plans, I'm sure, of what is planned to take place in the future. Let me read again from Still 'Tis Our Ancient Foe, page 97 through 99. It says, when Lenin defended the Jews, he laid the groundwork and led the revolution, which had as one of its main goals the blotting out of all Christian from the face of the earth. During his reign and in the years to follow, the churches in Russia were destroyed or turned into amusement centers, and the hundreds of thousands of the clergy of that great Christian nation were liquidated. Lenin's anti-Christ communist movement turned Russia into a human slaughterhouse. Christians were dragged from their beds, tortured and killed. Some were sliced to pieces, bit by bit, or branded with hot irons, even poking out their eyes to produce untold pain. Others were placed in boxes with only their heads, hands, and legs sticking out. Then hungry rats would be placed in the boxes to gnaw upon their bodies. Some were nailed to the ceiling by their fingers or their feet and left hanging until they died of exhaustion. Others were chained to the floor and hot lead poured into their mouths. Many were tied to horses and dragged through the streets of the city while the mob pummeled them with rocks and kicked them to death. Mothers were taken to the public square and their little babies would be snatched from their arms. A red would take one of the babies and hold it by the leg, head downward, and as he would demand that the Christian mother recant and deny Christ. When she would not, he tossed the baby into the air as another member of the mob would rush forward to catch it on the end of a bayonet as it fell. As the baby screamed and death rose, the other mothers would be given a chance to recant. Dresses would be ripped from the women, and the men of the mob would subject them to mass rape and other sexual atrocities. Tenders were misused so many times that they died on the spot, or were mentally and physically incapacitated for the rest of their lives. Pregnant Christian women were chained to trees and their unborn babies cut out of them. Many Christians were forced to dig their own graves, then were slowly buried alive. Many atrocities that took place are too shocking to relate, especially the sadistic acts performed upon little children. It was reported that in most villages, every Christian woman between the ages of 8 and 80 were subject to rape by the Red Butchers. And a little bit later he says, the Frankenstein of communism, socialism, is the product of the Jewish mind and was turned loose upon the world by the son of Rabbi Karl Marx, Moses Mordecai Marx Levi, alias Heinrich Karl Marx of Germany, in the hopes of destroying Christian civilization as well as all others. I don't like reading that to you, but I think it's important that we understand the Jewish mind, the mind of the enemy who is out to destroy American or Israel Christian today. You know, let us recognize our enemies and fight a smart fight. Let's stand and we'll pray. Heavenly Father, I have no qualms, Father, to stand here this morning and to ask, Father, for vengeance upon your enemies. Father, I know that even David said that we're to hate with a perfect hatred the enemies of yours. And Lord, there certainly are people who hate and despise you with the utmost hatred. And Father, I pray that these people, that their plans and the people themselves who are behind those plans will be destroyed. I have no qualms about doing that, even though maybe most of Christianity would think that to be very unchristian. But I know that I can look back to David and know that he prayed the same thing. Those indeed who are enemies, Father, I pray for their destruction. I pray for the freedom of Israel. I pray that you'd open their eyes that he could see and be used, Father, by you as a tool, Father, to accomplish the purpose of the kingdom. We glorify you, Father, the people here. We praise and magnify you in your Son, Yahshua. Amen.